tomorrow, and then we go back to normal time for interviews just in the early afternoon. Okay, is that clear? Very good. Okay, now we have the question time. Here we go. Here we go. Question number one. My mind gets all messed up. Well, you've come to the right place. When I try to do present moment awareness, when a thought arises, I noted it and let go immediately, without knowing another thought arises. And if I let go, and on, it's so noisy inside and doesn't seem to stop. Is this correct? Yeah, that's okay. What's wrong with being noisy inside? Now, it gives the important answer to that question. When you do present moment awareness, it's supposed to be unconditional awareness in the present moment. It doesn't matter what's happening, you allow it to be. So if it's noisy, great, welcome noise. So if you try and get rid of the noise because you don't like it, then that's where the problem arises in meditation. I don't want this, I want it to be like something else. In the Buddha's teachings, in one place, I think it's in the Anguttara Nikaya, one of the five great sections of suttas, the Buddha said that this is a path without groaning. So if you're groaning, you've missed the path. Groan, 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 moan, moan, moan. But of course, that's what happens, because that's what we mean by defilements, is groaning and moaning. So present moment awareness, it takes a time to get used to what we mean by that. So give yourself time to understand what present moment awareness is, until you understand and can reside in the present moment. If a thought comes, fine, come in thought. You can stay as long as you want. If it's noisy, fine, it can be noisy. If it's hot, fine, it can be hot. If it's cold, let it be cold. If a mosquito comes, let it bite you. What's wrong? Come on, you wimps. For those of you from overseas, a wimp is someone who's soft. Too soft. Got no endurance. It doesn't really matter, you're just staying in this present moment, you're accepting it for what it is, that you're allowing it to be. What happens is, the reason why we can't stay in the present moment is because we don't like it here, and so we want to go somewhere else, and that's where we go either back into the past, we go forward into the future, or we go perpendicular into fantasies. Anywhere but being here. So the point is, that if it's noisy, fine. If it's a thought, it's happening now, fine. Present moment awareness. It's like sometimes you see these parades going down the street. And if a parade is going down the street, you don't look to see what floats are coming. You don't go to the other direction and see what's already passed you by further up the road. You just look upon what's happening right next to you. The float, the exhibition, whatever it is, which is right in front of you, right now. So if you understand the simile of the parade, you just see what's happening now. A thought? Great, it's happening now, that's fine. Be with that thought. Feeling? Be with that feeling. Sound? Be with that sound. If you're seeing something, be with that. Always in the present moment. So somebody coughs, and it's gone. Because the problem is, when somebody coughs, or they make a noise, and then we start thinking, oh, why did they cough? They shouldn't have coughed. We should actually do a health check before we allow people to come in here. Actually, when I was in Singapore, they had these little cameras that you can see if you've got respiratory problems. You should have one of those in front of the door, and anyone who's got a tiny cough is not allowed to come into this meditation centre until they're cured. But of course, that's not the way you're going to get into deep meditation. You're going into deep meditation with the coughs, with the noise, with the mosquitoes, with the heat, with the cold, with the backache, with the stomachache, whatever else you've got. You allow it to be. That's what present moment awareness is. And I gave a little key to that, I think, this morning. And I call it unconditional mindfulness. That's a very important word, because it means mindfulness, you're not putting any conditions on what you're mindful of. No demands at all. So you can be mindful of a very noisy mind. You can be going all over the place. Great, just be mindful of it. You can be some really coarse, gross, deviant sexual fantasy. Just be mindful of it. At this particular point, later on it's a bit of a problem. And that doesn't apply to the monks and to sisters. So what we're doing is actually allow this moment to be and just watching it. Present moment, unconditional awareness. And if one does that, if the unconditional part is there as well, you embrace this moment, you allow it to be no matter what happens. The very fact you're not fighting it, you're not fighting the noise, you're not fighting the coughs, you're not fighting the pain, you're not fighting the body, because you're not fighting, it's unconditional, you're building up. That's why if you just allow the present moment to be, after a while it does become pleasant. This is its nature. As long as you don't fight, then peace will come up. If you're demanding, you have all these ideas of what meditation should be, then of course you're fighting for some fantasy, some idea, some goal, and you never find peace. So just allow this moment to be. The thoughts can be all over the place. Allow it to be. Many of you have heard me say this very important story with my life as a monk. It was my 6th year as a monk. And I found this beautiful monastery in the north of Thailand. Because I was an English monk, this was absolute perfection, because it was in the middle of a tea plantation. Had all the tea I could ever want, and had this beautiful monastery, which was I was the only monk there for about 6 months. Had a wonderful cave I used during the hot weather, and didn't hardly have any trouble to maintain it, even though I was by myself, and got very delicious food. It was absolutely perfect for me. And when the rains retreat started, 3 months nothing to do but meditate. It was perfect. Except for my mind. That wasn't perfect. And after 2 or 3 weeks, I may have had a month, I would say, that I started to lose my way in meditation. I started getting all these thoughts coming up into my mind. And I couldn't stop them. And they got worse and worse. I didn't have another monk to talk to. There was no teacher to go and ask questions. And after about 5 weeks, it was driving me crazy. I was thinking very, very unmonkish thoughts. And out of desperation, I went up to the Buddha statue in the main hall. I bowed and I made a resolution, determination. My determination was, please help me. I'm going to do a deal with my mind. For 23 hours of the day, let me watch my breath. For 1 hour of the day, and I put that out from 3 p.m. till 4 p.m. Every day, mind can think whatever you want. Anything goes. Romance, sex, science fiction. For that hour, anything goes. So if you want to think these things, okay, 3 till 4. The rest of the time, leave me alone. That was what the idea was. And if you haven't heard this story yet, it's a great story. What happened was that it didn't work. Not the way I expected, anyway. The mind was still as crazy as ever. It just would not behave. You know, the ordinary times, trying to watch the breath, this thought would come into my mind. I'd try and push it out, and it would sort of maybe go out for a second and come back again. But, you know, struggle all day. When it got to 3 p.m., I had to keep the other part of the bargain. So I stopped crying and watched the breath. I went up into my hut, leant against the wall, put my feet out and said, right, anything goes. And for the next hour, it was the most peaceful hour of the day. All I could see was the breath going in and out, and it was just so easy. And it taught me an important lesson. It was very clear that my problem was I was trying to control my mind too much. The harder I forced, But why my mind went crazy. Actually, I learned a very important lesson there about what the way of meditation is. It's not controlling your mind. If you try and push those thoughts out, you'll find them all coming. So you say, okay, you can come in if you like. Come on, come in. And they don't want to come then. You're no fun anymore. You don't get upset. Because you're making peace with those thoughts, then you gain peace. When you make war with your mind, you get what we call collateral damage. That's what Mr. Bush calls it. I think you know what collateral damage is. You get so crazy, you get headaches, nothing's going right, you get depressed and frustrated. The collateral damage is trying to control your mind. So unconditional mindfulness. You're alert, you're awake, whatever happens. And you're making peace with it. Making peace means you accept it. You're learning to coexist peacefully with your mind. And it's that peaceful coexistence which stops the war. Because you're not feeding the defilements anymore. What happens, in just unconditional mindfulness, you just watch. Whatever happens. And the only place you can really watch is in the present moment. And after a while, the mind settles down. It settles down by itself. Just as I said this morning, that leaf, up and down, it's because of the wind. And you find later on in your meditation when you get deep, that wind which makes your mind move is this thing I call the doer, the controller, craving. Attachment. You're attached to your mind. That's why you want to be it like this, you want to be it like that. You can't let it go. So when you make peace with the mind, peace with the moment, then you find this present moment is fine. You're not demanding of what it's going to be. You can be thinking of you all over the place. At that particular time of meditation, this first stage, present moment awareness, just watch to see what's there. But don't try and make it be like this or be like that. That's the present moment awareness. It's great because you don't have to do anything. There's no sort of good, no bad, no measuring, no trying to be like this or be like that. You're just watching, that's all. That's easy. Yes?
Is this the same or similar to using thought as the object of meditation? Sometimes I do that and I'm not sure if it's the same thing.
It can be the same thing. You're asking, is it the same as using thought as the object of meditation? It's not quite the same, but it's similar. Because with thought, actually, you're deciding, I'm going to watch my thoughts. And that is the main object, the main purpose. Here, you're saying, I'm going to watch whatever is happening in the present moment. It's a thought, fine. It's the sound of some helicopter, that's fine. It's the sound of someone moving, that's fine. So the main point is it's happening now. Doesn't matter what it is, if it's happening now, that's what I'm going to look at. That's what I'm going to feel. That's what I'm going to know. The content of my consciousness now. There can be a thought, there also can be a sound, there can be a feeling in your foot. Whatever's happening now, that's what you watch. Yeah, number two.
When done this, I feel scattered, even though now I'm watching my thought, now I'm watching my perception of the airplane now, and I don't get a sense of peace.
Aha! You get it, and you say that sometimes when you do this, you feel like scattered, you don't get a sense of peace. You don't get a sense of peace because you're not accepting what you're watching. You want it to be different. Trying to have some idea, if I want to be at peace, this isn't peace, but this isn't what I like. Now the thing is, one can't expect peace, one has to make peace. So when you're watching the present moment, as a little skillful means, as a little trick, you can deliberately say to this present moment, I make peace with you. If you're scattered, I make peace with the scattered mind. If you're angry, make peace with the angry mind. If you're tired, make peace with the tired mind. If you're bright, make peace with the bright mind. You make peace with whatever's happening now. And every moment you make peace, it's like a brick of peace in the big building you're constructing. And every time you lay one brick of peace by making peace with this moment, you're building up, you're constructing this huge thing we call the house of peace. And you've got enough bricks, you've done it enough times, you're peaceful. That's how you make peace. You make peace with this moment. You make peace with yourself. You make peace with your meditation. Ah, in your mind, you're going to think around, well, that's okay with me. Because in Buddhism, it's not your mind. It's anatta, not me, not mine, not the self. It just goes according to conditions, that's all. You're thinking because that's what all the cause is. You've been thinking before you come here. It takes the time to slow down. What do you expect? So be at peace with yourself. Be at peace with your mind. And that way, you've got this kindness, this softness. You give the opportunity for the mind to slow down. By making peace, you're not making it worse. You're making it a lot better. And after a short while, it just becomes still. Make peace with the scattered mind. And it starts being scattered, yeah? Same with the tired mind. Any of you are really sleepy. Make peace with the sleepy mind. Say, mind, you're dull. What's wrong with that? Be dull. There was. In the Zen tradition, one of the great masters of Zen, Lin Chi, otherwise known as Rinzai, and he was in the retreat once. And you know what happens in those Zen retreats. They're not soft like Ajahn Brahm's retreats. There they get one of the monks, goes up and down the line with this big stick. And if you nod even a small amount, anything over 2 millimeters, you get whacked on the back with this big stick. And I went to a retreat once like that in the north of England years ago. And in the morning, this guy came with this big stick. And lots of us were very tired. But I was very fortunate. There was one person sitting next to me who was more tired than I was. That was very lucky. So he got hit with the stick. And once I heard that, I was not sleepy at all. I was very alert. But here, or rather in the story of Rinzai, he was in this big session with his fierce master. And look, he was sleeping. He wasn't even trying, because his head was right down, almost touching the ground. And when the master walked in with the stick, out of compassion, the monk sitting next to him nudged him. Hey, look out, the master's coming. And this guy was inside, a great hero of mine. He just opened one eye, looked, only one eye, because he was being efficient. He just looked at the master and said, oh, it's only him, and carried on sleeping. And at that, the master exploded. You think you're monks in this monastery. There's only one real monk in this monastery, that's Rinzai. Cease letting go. Good on you. But you are the monks. And he blasted all the other monks except Rinzai. Now, that was a great story. Because he had the guts, just because it was his nature, just to be sleepy. He was tired, poor thing. It's a big deal. But sometimes we get in here and we start nodding. Oh, I can't start nodding now. What will people think of me? I've got my reputation to keep. And stop thinking like that. If you're tired, be tired. Why are you tired? It's because all the causes and conditions of tiredness have built up. Maybe you've, you know, had a busy day. Maybe you're not quite well. Maybe it's the heat, the cold, the rhythms of your body, the food. Who knows what it is? But you're tired. So just be mindful, I'm tired, and go to sleep. If you make peace with your tiredness, it doesn't last that long. If you fight your tiredness, it lasts a long time. I know that from bitter experience. I used to get up 3 o'clock in the morning in these monasteries in Thailand, and it was hotter than this. And our diet was very, so bad that we didn't really have much energy. So it was just so tiring. We used to be very sleepy in the morning. And I used to fight that sleepiness. I just really try hard just to watch the breath or do all these other practices to try and stop being tired. Actually, one of the practices which I did, you used to put an empty matchbox on top of your head to take the cover off with all these matches and put it on top of your head. Because, you know, if you sort of started nodding, it would fall off. All the matches would go on the floor. So that's what I did. I put this matchbox to the matchbox practice. The reason I stopped doing that was because I thought it worked. I thought it would stop me nodding during meditation. And one of the monks took me aside and said, "Damn Brahm, so I've been watching you. I know now why the matchbox isn't poor, because when you actually start nodding, you nod like this." That doesn't work that way. So, oh, what the hell? And the trouble was that when you really try hard to stop being sleepy, when you actually do break through the sleepiness, you're restless. You can't be still at all, you start thinking a lot. And so I was oscillating between being restless or being sleepy, being restless and being sleepy. I couldn't find that middle where you were just really peaceful but really alert. And the reason why was because that when I was sleepy, I was trying so hard that when you broke through, that try just made the mind just wobble all over the place. When I try and calm down that wobble and just go back into sleepiness. These days I know how to overcome that. You feel sleepy, you make peace with sleepiness. Allow it to be. Because you're making peace, you're not using up all of your limited amount of energy. By making peace, you're not wasting, you know, the force of your mind. And just the sleepiness, like anything else, it just disappears after a while. Very soon, usually. And the energy comes back. When it comes out, because you've been making peace with sleepiness all the time, when energy does come back, you're not restless, but you're still. But just allow sleepiness to be. Don't force it. Whatever you experience with present moment awareness, make peace with it. It's called another way of saying let it go. Let it be. Stop fighting. That's a very important part of meditation. Don't fight. Don't be a warrior. Buddhism is a compassionate, it's a non-violent religion. But lots of meditators are violent to their mind. Oh, that's terrible. So, be very peaceful with your mind. Okay? But be patient, it takes a while for this to work. So, you know, don't think, okay, I'm going to make peace with my mind. I've been doing this for 2 minutes, why aren't I in jhana now? It takes a while just to slow down and then it happens. Okay, great question. Question number 2. My wife is Jewish and I have agreed to raise our children Jewish. Once the children are older, my daughter's about 2 years, okay, and something looks like 4 meters, but she can't be 4 meters. It's about 2 years, something. And we have one daughter due to be born in March. Then I'll introduce them to the concept of mindfulness and meditation. But without Buddhist labels, so as to keep the peace with my wife. One part of my life with her that is stressful is temple. She drags me there sometimes and I allow her to do so. Though I must admit it's quite reluctant. Part of what makes me dislike it so much is I don't necessarily agree with the points made or philosophies. I know that the mind is conditioned, so I also resist allowing to be exposed to the Jewish threads of something, logic and philosophy in our temple. Do you have any suggestions? Divorce is not an option. Okay. There's nothing wrong with going to places, to go to the synagogues or whatever. And it's actually great that you can actually introduce rational principles. There is, I gave a talk about a couple of weeks ago in Naramara about helping children with their difficulties, or helping children with their problems, I think it was called. And one of the pieces of advice I gave there was coming from a story which I was told a long time ago. There was one of our monks in England was approached by a couple. They were Buddhists, they were an English couple, and they just had their first child, and they were obviously very concerned about how to bring it up, and they asked advice, shall we bring our child up as a Buddhist? The monk said, no, don't bring your child up as a Buddhist. Don't bring your child up as anything, but teach your child how to question and how to be honest. Encourage those two skills or character traits in your child. Whenever they question, never just say, oh, don't bother me. Encourage that. Give them the answer if you don't know. Just say you don't know, or find out, or help them find out for themselves. So encourage them to question. Number two, always encourage them to be very honest. Not just in what they say, but in how they think. So they never stop at a half-truth, which doesn't make sense to them. They have this sense of being honest to themselves and honest to life. He said, if you actually encourage your children with those two qualities, questioning and honesty, if Buddhism is a good religion, then they'll find it themselves. You're equipping them to stop getting lost in stupid cults which have no logical, rational foundation in them, and you're allowing them to find their religion for themselves. So I think it was a wonderful piece of advice. So the best thing is that, no, if Judaism is a good religion, let the kids find it for themselves. If Buddhism is a good religion, let them find it for themselves. Let's give them the skills to live in this life, and with all these spiritual paths and religious teachings, these cults, these sects, so they can actually find their way through the forest of different spiritualities. And if they always question, they'll always be able to probe to find the truth. And honesty will stop them being satisfied with the half truth. So I'm sure that, whoever wrote that question, if you tell your wife that story, say, okay, you can go to the temple, but I'm going to teach them honesty. I'm going to teach them to question. And they can question the rabbi, they can question the monk, they can question you, they can question me as much as they like. I'm going to encourage them. I'm going to encourage them to be honest, so they can actually find their spirituality. They can go to the Jewish temple, they can go to the church, they can go to the mosque. I'm going to encourage them to go everywhere, so they can actually learn. And that questioning and honesty will stop them getting brainwashed by anybody. That's why we have question time here. Encourage that, the toughest of questions. And they never actually have a question here, say, I'm not going to answer that one, just throw it away. They always answer it. Even if you don't know, you say, I don't know. So that's actually one of the things to do. And actually, I know that when we went to that recent conference, the global conference in Singapore last June, I think it was about six rabbis came along sitting in the back, because they wanted to actually find out why it was so many Jewish people becoming Buddhists. They even got a word for it, in the US it's called Jew-Buddhists. It's true, they call it Jew-Buddhists. There's so many Jewish people becoming Buddhists. And the rabbis were a bit concerned. They came from, I think, from Israel. And they were trying to find out, and they wanted to find out from someone who could speak English. So they came to this conference and just sat in the back and just took notes. So yeah, that happens. Just encourage your kids to be honest and to question. And then you're equipping them, and no one can argue with that. And then your wife will say, that's a good idea. And maybe actually your wife and yourself can also practice questioning and being honest. Because sometimes religious people say some stupid things. And people just believe it, just because it's somebody on high. And they don't question enough. unfortunately, in Western traditions, the questioning is just usually encouraged. At least it's seen as worthwhile and valid. So question, 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 be honest. Okay? Okay, the next question here. Can I use the breath to calm the mind, to develop mindfulness of the present moment? You can use the breath, but if you use the breath too quickly, just what happens is you never get peaceful. It just becomes force. And because sometimes people start with the breath too early and they can't really keep the breath in mind, they struggle so hard on the breath, they get headaches. It's called samadhi headache. I never heard that at all before I actually went to Malaysia. And I heard all these people complaining of samadhi headache. And I thought, well, what have you been doing? And they've been trying too hard to watch the breath and trying it too quickly. Calm the mind down, first of all. Settle down. And then watch the breath. If you watch the breath too quickly, you're not ready for it. You have to use so much force. It's such a struggle. It's a war. And I've already mentioned, when you have a war with your mind, you're always going to lose. So no war, make peace. Do it slowly, do it gently. You've got 9 whole days here, so you've got plenty of time to become enlightened. Go to bed early tonight, get light tomorrow. In other words, don't have this great ambition. However, when you're doing present moment awareness, if it's the breath which is in your mind, that's okay. But it's not the breath aspect that you watch as much as the fact that's happening now. Now, whenever you have any experience at all, there's always so many different perceptions you can take. For example, I can lift up this, and you can look at its colour, you can look at its size, you can look at its function, holding questions. You look at its history, once it's had ice cream in it, I wonder where the ice cream went. Or you can look at its weight. There's so many different aspects of this. But when you're watching the breath and you're trying to do present moment awareness, it's that aspect of this experience called now. That's what's most important to you. So don't worry about the breath going in or out, rough or smooth. The fact that's happening now, the nowness, is what you watch. The nowness of the experience. That's the aspect which you're observing, you're making important when you're doing present moment awareness. If you've got an itch, it's the nowness of that itch which is most important to you. The fact that's happening in this very moment. It's the sound, it's the nowness of that sound which is important to you. The fact that's happening in this moment. If it's a thought, it's the nowness of the thought. You're experiencing it in this moment. So you can watch the breath, you can watch the thought, you can watch anything, but you take out that aspect called the nowness. So you know this is present moment. It's really strange that sometimes that people have a hard time getting into this. What is this present moment awareness? You know, once you've trained yourself, it's very easy. One of the reasons why people find it hard is because we hardly ever live in the present moment. We don't know what it is. So it's just like having a leg and never realizing you've got a leg. You're never looking in that direction. So it's actually interesting why people find it so difficult to be in the present moment. Because you've hardly ever lived there at all. In all the years since you've been born, so rare you've just been present. When I ask you to, you don't know what it is. So learn how to be present. And once you learn that skill, oh, it's wonderful. Many, many times of your life, you can just look at the nowness of whatever you're experiencing. Once you notice that, you can't do anything about it. You have to let go, because it's here. It's already come. Too late now. And you realize this nowness, that all the whole universe, the whole causes, so many different things have come together to bring this moment called now, and here it is. So celebrate it. How hard have you worked to get here? How much have you sacrificed? how many you've put, done all your work, got the time off, looked after your home, your other duties, so you're free to actually to be here at this retreat. Even at this moment, you've washed, you've showered, you've had your food, you've been to the toilet, now you're here listening to this moment. Don't waste it. You've worked so hard to get here. So enjoy this moment. The trouble is, most people, they work so hard to get here, and as soon as they're here, they're working hard to get somewhere else. They're always going somewhere else, never here. We never stop. We're always on the move, always running. Until we reach our death. And there we are. We've run all our life, never stopped for a moment. So you can be aware of your breath, but it's the nowness of it which is most important. Is that quite clear? Sort of. Okay. Okay, the next question. Here we go. I should not have said I come from any country. I am perhaps just energy manifested by the four elements contacting. Therefore, when we die and the elements leave us, do the elements contained in the soul join the universal force? Maybe the mind and soul separate at this time, and then the mind manifests itself as another being depending on our actions. Through successful meditation, does the mind stop manifesting again, and therefore join the something energy? Is that Nirvana? Thank you very much. I can't help thinking. Maybe can't help thinking, so leave it alone. You're beyond help, so leave it alone. What happens when you die? Sometimes, that old Zen story about this monk who was asked, do you believe in life after death? And he said, I don't know. Why don't you know? Because I haven't died yet, he said. But he was wrong. He has died yet. He just forgot, that's all. You've died before, so you've been there, you've done that, and just forgotten. I've already mentioned that when you have mindfulness, strong mindfulness, powerful mindfulness, you can remember things. So when you get deep in this meditation, when you get really deep, maybe you can remember what it was like to die the last time. What happens next after your body's dead? And then you're actually remembering from personal experience, not theories and ideas. And you think until you're crazy about all these things, and you can fight over your thoughts with the person sitting next to you. But it doesn't really make any difference. When you see things for yourself and experience those things, then you will know. I will talk about this later on, because hopefully some of you will get into deep enough meditation, you may be able to start understanding what we mean by recollecting past lives. And at least you may recollect your early life when you were a baby. A few people have done that on these retreats, and it's actually quite moving. They can actually see themselves as a baby and understand just how you can recollect these things. You do this, again, just because your mind becomes powerful. We're empowering the mind in this meditation. And one of the things I've been talking about recently in the retreats, and when we talk about insights, in the traditional Buddhism, there's three big insights. There was the three insights which the Buddha got under the Bodhi tree. The three big insights. It's called Tevijja, the three knowledges. So what was the first insight which the Buddha got under the Bodhi tree in the first watch of the night? Who knows? Any suggestions? Yeah, he recollected his past lives. That was his first insight. Later on in another sutta, he's called that like a chicken sitting on its eggs, like a hen incubating the eggs. That's the first breaking through of the eggshell. Breaking through to truth. Finding out, yes, were born before and died before. What was the second insight that she got? The law of karma. How you get reborn, what this whole process is, why, where you came from. And the third insight was into the Four Noble Truths. Those were the three insights. The first, second and third, breaking through the egg. Of course, once you broke through that last one, you were hatched. And then the Arahant. So it's marvellous actually that those are important insights. How do you teach those? You may not actually fully remember your past life, but at least you find out the way to do it. So this is actually, once you know and you can actually see what happened to you, then you know exactly, you know, that you are from any particular country, you're not a man, you're not a woman, you recollect yourself as somebody else last time. And also you start to see just how rebirth happens. This is where, if you want to know the full answer, the way that people get reborn is without a soul. That's sometimes people actually ask me that. Said in Buddhism they say there's no soul, but there's rebirth. How can that be? How can you have rebirth when there's nothing actually goes across from one life to the other? That is the whole purpose of the Buddha teaching dependent origination. The whole purpose of that teaching of Paticca Samuppada, to show how there's rebirth without any soul going across. That's why he did that. It's very deep teaching, but it's not beyond your understanding, especially if you can calm the mind down and find out what this mind is. It's just a process, that's all. So when you get into deep meditation, you may be able to see your past life. If you don't see your past lives, you'll be able to see your mind. And then you'll understand what this thing is that some people call a soul. What is the mind? What is consciousness? You'll be able to see that because it's right in front of you. And then you'll be able to know why the Buddha said it's empty. But you will never get to that truth by thinking. All you think, the rest you know. So, yeah, you've been thinking all your life. Keeps you thinking, just gives more money to the makers of Panadol and aspirin. So, stop the thinking and do the seeing. Experience, rather than have all these words. But later on during this retreat, I will give talks on non-self. I may even give a talk on dependent origination. But we need a little bit more experience first of all. So we're going to make ourselves quiet first of all. And then in that quietness you get an understanding of what we're talking about. Any questions about that? Go on, yeah.
Is there a first life? I mean, you keep getting born.
No, there cannot be a first life. It doesn't make any sense of being the first life. It is the first life. Then what was before that first life? There cannot be a first life. It's been going on, endless. Think of a circle. A circle has no beginning and no end, but it really is. It's just like when I was a young kid. You used to start to think about the universe. And start to think of like the end of the universe. I started to imagine it's a big wall. With a big sign on it. No one passed here. It was the end of the universe. You know, as a kid, you sort of try to figure out what it's going to be. Because, can there be a wall at the end of this universe? You know, before the people thought there was a flat earth, and then there's a big waterfall, and you fell off. And then they started thinking it's a flat universe. There must be some end to this universe. It was great doing science, doing physics, and astrophysics. And you find that this universe is actually, it's a finite volume. It's got no edge to it. Just like a sphere has got a finite surface area, it's got no edge to it, it's got no boundaries. This universe is the same. So it's marvellous that you can think, yeah, there's actually a fact there, this universe has got finite volume, but it's got no edge to it. No beginning, no end. So a lot of time, beginnings and ends, actually just means we haven't, you know, our mind hasn't been trained well enough to see other possibilities. The first cause doesn't make sense. However, the social cause or sphere, spherical, get some ideas, an endless beginning, unbounded. That's you. Isn't that nice? I think it's nice anyway. Any questions on that? Okay, let's get another question. How to guide a person who is basically kind but always gets angry spontaneously when provoked? Haha, they're not basically kind, are they? If they were basically kind, they would never get angry. No one can provoke you to get angry. You let them make you angry. That's all. So why do you let other people make you angry? Because sometimes you allow your mind to make you angry, don't you? You're sitting here and you think, you know, stupid mind. Come on, I've been sitting here all day. I haven't got one moment of peace yet. Stupid mind. Come on. Right, we're going to really do it this time, aren't we, mind? You better do this, otherwise you're going to be in big trouble. That's how people meditate like that. They're forceful. They've got angry characters. If you were basically kind, you'd be enlightened very quickly. Oh, mind. If you want to sleep, that's fine. You want to go to sleep. There's all this nice walls there. Lean back and just go to sleep. Be really kind. You want to sleep, fine. If you want to have an extra piece of toast in the morning, go on. Be kind. Now, if you do things like that, it means that the mind wants to play with you. If you play with the mind will play with you. So then you say, oh, come on, mind, watch the pen. If it's not too much bother for you, if you don't feel like it, that's fine with me, we'll do it later. And you use that sort of psychology with your mind, that kindness. And the mind wants to watch the pen. Isn't that the way in life, if you're kind to someone, you say, hey, would you mind, you know, just helping me out this evening? With kindness, do you actually want to help kind people? They really appreciate it, and the way they say it to you is just so nice. Oh, I want to do this for that guy. And that's what the mind does. If you're really kind to the mind and the body, you say, body, come on, can you just sit still for half an hour? That's too much, 25 minutes. You see, we just work together. With that kindness to your body, you look at the body, see if it needs a scratch here or needs to move here. And then you're kind to your body. And then your body will usually be comfortable. If you're not kind to the body, you're forcing the body. How long can I sit meditation for? An hour? I'm going to do an hour and a half. An hour and a half? No, I'm going to do 2 hours this meditation retreat. Last time, I can only do 2.25 hours. This one I'm going to do 3 hours. And you sit down there and you get in there and you say, right, this is it. 3 hours, I'm not going to move. And being angry, it's not being kind. It's trying to dominate your body. And your body will rebel. If you're kind, you say, come on, body. Nice body. If you're comfortable, you keep on. Then it sits for 4 hours. You get much more out of people when you're kind to them. Saying out of your mind. If you're kind to your mind, you get much more out of it. You're a troubled mind, kind mind. You want to think? Okay, go and think. When you finish, we go back to bed, okay? And if you're kind to your mind, the mind wants to play. And it's very easy to watch the mind then. So be kind. If you're basically kind, it's very easy to meditate. That's why later on we'll do some compassionate breath meditation. So you combine loving kindness with breath meditation. Do the two together. Say, beautiful breath, kind breath, loving breath. Please, can we play together? Yes. Yeah. You're determined to be kind. You're determined to give up determining things. That's the way of the world. So you can turn yourself again on your chair, go on your anything as Krishna, then let go. You're determined to let go. There's another way of making determinations, though, and I mentioned that yesterday. It's programming the mind. Just like I said, you're determined to get up in the morning at, say, 5 o'clock or 4 o'clock or 3 o'clock, whatever it is, you just say to yourself before you go to sleep, I'll get up at 3 o'clock. I'll get up at 3 o'clock. I'll wake up at 3 o'clock. And then you forget about it. That's where you can determine. You just say one or two things and then you don't force it. You make a kind suggestion. The problem with most people, they're controlling so they don't give it an opportunity to work. I usually gave the simile of the taxi driver. The simile of the taxi driver goes like this. As many people from Singapore, they have to catch a plane. And so they order a taxi and it waits outside of this in the car park. You put your baggage in the back, you sit next to the taxi driver and said, I want to go to Perth Airport. I want to go this way, don't go that way. I want you to keep the speed limit, not above the speed limit, but not below the speed limit. And I'm a Buddhist, so anyone who wants to come in, please let them in front of me because I'm compassionate. And please don't talk while we're driving because I want to meditate, I want to be mindful. And don't put on the radio and don't smoke. And if you carry on like that, even before you get to the bottom of the road, the taxi driver will throw you out and say, get another taxi. I'm not going to take you. Shut up. Look, I know how to drive. I know how to do my job. Stop interfering. Now, that simile is what many people do when they say, watch the breath. They come online, watch the breath. Now, don't do it this way. Do it that way. And don't talk while you're watching the breath. And don't think of the future. Don't think of the past. Do it this way. Don't do it that way. The poor old mind just rebels. And throws you out. So instead, the wise person, they get in the taxi, they sit in the back and say, taxi driver, take me to Perth Airport. Every taxi driver in this city knows where the airport is. Well, you have to say international, domestic, because it's from places, but half of that. International. And then you can just relax and let go. And after what? 20 minutes, half an hour, you're at the airport. That's with the mind. Give it very clear instructions, but be kind, be soft, and let the mind take you to your destination. But don't interfere on the journey. We interfere too much. That's as far as determination goes. When we get involved too much, we're just too forceful. Be soft. So kindness. You say to that taxi driver, oh, kind taxi driver, if it's not too much problem for you, would you please take the vehicle? If you're really, really kind and smart, oh, yes, sir. You probably take off 10%. Kindness is very, very good. And so, how to guide a person who gets angry spontaneously when provoked? They're basically kind. Everyone has got their triggers. Once you know what the trigger is, you can actually, again, this is again programming mindfulness. What is your danger? I use this as a simile of the snake. It's a very good simile to say now because it will stop you getting into too many problems during this meditation retreat. Those of you who have meditated many, many times before, sometimes you get to a point in your meditation and it all falls apart and you make the same mistake again and again and again. At least you know what that mistake is. Once you know what that mistake is, you keep on repeating it. You can use this simile of the snake. In the monasteries in Thailand where I grew up, they were so poor that sometimes we didn't have any shoes to wear, no sandals, and even the flashlights, we had flashlights but no batteries. I remember many times going to Ajahn Chah Sat, can I have some more batteries that run out? He said, we've got no batteries. There aren't any. Which may not seem a bad thing for you, but we used to have the meetings in the middle of the night, we had to go back to our huts through the jungle, and there were snakes in that jungle. Another thing which regarded you as their dinner. And those snakes were hungry. And so you had to walk in the dark, or by the starlight, just a little bit of light which filtered through the canopy of the trees. On these paths, knowing there were snakes. you have no shoes, and you have no fashion. Now, I knew that was dangerous. So all the way from the main hall to my hut, I was on the lookout all the time. And if I saw like a dark shape across the path, I don't have any flashlight. It could have been a twig, but it could be a snake. So I either jumped over it, or I went another way. I never got bitten, because I was always on the lookout for the snakes. They were danger, they were on the path there somewhere. I was always look out for them, that's why I never got caught by them. That's called a sin of the snake. On the path of meditation, you may not have a strong flashlight, you've certainly got no shoes. There are things in there, in your meditation, stopping you getting home into the jhanas, into enlightenment. What are the things which you always catch you out? It could be anger, it could be sort of excitement, it could be controlling when you get very deep, it could be fear. Whatever is on your problem which keeps on coming up, you tell yourself at the beginning of the meditation, this is my problem, look out for it, it's dangerous. And if you know it's waiting for you and you're really looking out for it, you'll see it before it catches you and you'll be able to jump over it or take another path, and it never catches you. If it's anger, if that's your snake or your friend's snake, tell them, look, that's a danger. It's caused you so much problem and suffering and pain. Look out for that one. And if they're really looking out for it, like I was looking out for the snakes, they see anger about to bite them, and they'll either take a different route or they'll jump over them. They don't get caught. Programming mindfulness. In the sense of telling mindfulness, what's the danger? And telling mindfulness, look out for that. Then mindfulness will see it and avoid it. That's what happens. That's how you can tell someone, to actually help them to avoid the anger. And then, and it avoided the anger and the whole inner anger has all disappeared, then they will be basically kind. And when you're basically kind, then you've got no problems at all. Meditation is so easy. Really, really kind people have an easy time meditating. Because they're kind to everything. They're kind to the moment, they're kind to the silence, they're kind to the breath. Even when they get this beautiful nimitta, they're kind to the nimitta. Oh dear nimitta, you can come if you want. If you don't really want to say, if you're busy, you can go, it's okay with me. You're kind to nimittas, the beautiful lights in the night. You don't try and control them and own them. If they go, oh that's alright with me. If they say, oh that's alright with me, you're letting go. That's why the nimittas, they come, oh this is a nice meditation, I'm going to stick around with this guy. Let's stick around. Be kind. Can't go wrong with being kind to your body, being kind to your mind. Okay? Next question. Dear Ajahn, what is sloth and torpor? How does one know if one is in sloth and torpor? How is it differentiated from deep meditation? That's three questions. I said only one question. But because we just talked about kindness, I've got to be kind to the person who asked this question. What is sloth and torpor? Okay, I think sloth is for lack of energy in the body. Torpor is lack of energy in the mind. It is natural to have sloth and torpor from time to time. Because sometimes you've been working hard. You've been up late at night, you're going to be physically tired. You know what the cause of mental tiredness is? It's because you've been thinking too much. So no wonder your poor old brain has had enough. Which is why the first couple of days of a meditation retreat, I expect lots of sloth and torpor. That's why when I see people getting dozy, I think, person's actually allowing their nature to manifest. All of those who are just trying really hard and gritting their teeth and not smiling. You're just putting off the time. You've got to sleep sooner or later, so just get it over and done with the first few days and then you can enjoy it later on. Instead of like trying to fight it right now and just get even more tense and more tired because of all the fighting and controlling you're doing. This is an important part of meditation. This is, if you want to understand what mindfulness is and how it works, listen to this. The mind has got a certain amount of energy. We waste it all in thinking and controlling and doing. The doer, the controller, the thinker, it's all the same. That takes up the lion's share of mental energy. And what's left, the crumbs, go to knowing. The ability just to see, to hear, to know what's going on. Which is why, because we think we control, we're rushing around, controlling our body, trying to get here, doing this, doing that. Because we're rushing around so much, that's why we get mentally tired. And if we have that tiredness, we try and control that. The little energy we have goes into doing, controlling, thinking. And it means we never get out of stop and talk. The energy is going into the wrong place. So once you understand this, instead of controlling and doing, you're doing letting go, being kind, being at peace with things, being content to allow this moment to manifest, whatever it is, according to its causes and effects. We just get out of the way. We don't control anymore. We don't do things. We don't do meditation. Once we stop doing things, the energy of the mind, instead of being wasted in thinking, controlling, doing, managing, fault-finding, the energy of the mind flows into knowing. Pure knowing. Mindfulness. Awareness. Awareness isn't just one little thing. It actually has different levels of awareness, mindfulness. Once it starts flowing into mindfulness, the mindfulness wakes up and gets stronger and stronger and stronger. You're more aware. What you know deeper. You get more information. Whatever you see, hear, feel, you feel it deeper. Because the energy is starting going into mindfulness. Those of you who read some of those little talks I've given in the journal, I call this power mindfulness, superpower mindfulness. The energy just starts going into mindfulness. And when you get into superpower mindfulness, then you're buzzing along. Whatever you look at, you see it so much deeper than you've ever seen it before. A leaf looks so much greener than you've ever seen any green before in your whole life. Sounds. You can just feel so much of the texture of the sound. Because the mindfulness is waking up. The energy when it goes into the knowing. It's like a flashlight has its batteries empowered. And the light which you have is not just 1 watt, it's 100 watts, it's 1,000 watts, it's 1,000,000 watts. Whatever you look at, you can see it just it's highlighted. You see more of it. If you go out into the garden now, the moon will be up soon. You'll be able to see the garden by moonlight, but you can't see all the details. In the sunlight, in the early morning, you can see much more. But in the middle of the day, under the bright sun, there you can see all the details, the little speckles on the leaves. Maybe some of the little insects which are crawling on it. That's what I mean by superpower mindfulness. So what happens when my energy goes into the mind, into the knowing rather than into the doing? The mind wakes up. You see much deeper. Not only that, because you've got mental energy, you get happy as well. That's where the bliss comes from in meditation. That's why it's a beautiful thing. That's why nimitta is just so powerfully beautiful. Focus not doing anything. So don't do too much in the first couple of days. So you get sloth, you get fog, you get sleepy. That's fine, that's part of the course. Allow yourself to be sleepy. If you struggle with sleepiness, if you struggle with your meditation, you won't get anywhere. If you allow things to be, you go through sleepiness, you go through the tiredness. Middle of the retreat, you start sleeping less because your mind is more awake. You start getting happy, you start getting blissed out, you have big smiles on your face. And that's why, whenever we take the photograph at the end of a retreat, and then we do that photograph at the end of the retreat. That's why my retreats everyone looks miserable. Because they have to go home. And other people's retreats, when you take that photograph at the end of the retreat, everyone looks happy. Because the retreat's over and they're going home. I prefer my photograph. Oh, the retreat's over. Oh, I don't want to go back to Singapore. I don't want to go back to LA. I don't want to go. Oh, too much of time. Would that be nice if that was you? Mm-hmm. At the end of the retreat, you think, oh, I don't want this to end ever. That's what happens when you get into deep meditation. Mindfulness goes into the knowing, not the doing. Mind wakes up. It energizes. It's fun. You're awake at last. You're alert. You see things. Superpower mindfulness. And what you see looks so beautiful. That's why I say, if you do this practice, actually it's amazing, this food today, just how much we have, but it gets better as your mind becomes more energized. Imagine that. You have 5-star cuisine today, tomorrow 6-star, 7-star. By the end of the retreat, that's 14-star cuisine. Oh, amazing. Just because your mind is, you know, 14-star. So that's sloth and torpor. How do you know if one's in sloth and torpor? Sometimes when you're in sloth and torpor, you can sort of recognize it just by a few signs. But you can't know it too much because the mind is by its nature dull. But you can recognize it. You can tell your mind, if I recognize that little sign, sloth and torpor, I'm going to let it be. I'm not going to fight. If you really don't pay time, go and take a rest. That's why you've got rooms by yourself. You can sneak in there, no one knows you're going in there. They don't need to feel ashamed. And people might even think you're going in there to meditate. I call that actually meditating flat out. So go and take a rest. Do that the first couple of days, and you find that later on you don't need a rest. It's natural, you want to be away, you want to sit more. And it's not because you're trying to prove anything, it's because it's quite natural, just the energy, you just want to keep on meditating. And that's always the best type of meditation. And how is it differentiated from deep meditation? Deep meditation, oh, you can't sleep after deep meditation. You just now, go to bed, no way you can sleep, so you just come back in here and carry on meditating, you want to do walking meditation. It's as happy as can be. And maybe tomorrow morning you can sleep, or in the afternoon or whatever. But from deep meditation, you have happiness. More happiness than you've known. You have energy. But not sort of restless energy. The body is still there, but it's constituted very alert. In the moment, focused, energized, happy. Having a wonderful time. So the amount of happiness is a sign of the depth of meditation. And it's also the sign of the power of your mindfulness. The more mindfulness you have, the happier you feel. Okay, see you next question. Ajahn, what is the primary object we should note or focus on to develop the single-pointedness mindfulness skill? Thank you. Okay. Single-pointedness is actually, the word is ekagata. It doesn't mean just a point, it means a peak. It's an agga. You may know that word. That agga is the Pali word. Many of you will recognize the meaning of that word when I tell you the Sanskrit form of agga. Eka is one, agga, and ta means ness, like one agga ness, literally. Because the Sanskrit form of agga is agra. Does that ring any bells? Agra? How many of you have been to Agra? It's Taj Mahal there, isn't it? You know why the Taj Mahal is there in the Red Fort? Because Agra was the capital of the Mughals in India. It was the peak, the chief, the head city. And that's what Agra means. Agra means the peak, like some summit. So it doesn't mean an ordinary point, it means like, you know, the heights of the mind. Ekagata. So here, actually, when we focus on developing that single pointedness, actually get to the peak. peak of the mind. We have to let go of so much things. It's not so much what we focus on as what we let go of. It's not so much what we do, because focusing is like doing, isn't it? Okay, concentrate. Concentrate on my nose now. Come on, concentrate on my nose. So hard to do. But if you say, don't concentrate on my nose, just let go of everything else. Just let go of you, let go of space, let go of my head, let go of everything except my nose. That's how we focus, by letting go of things. So this is actually the way we talk about one-pointedness. We let go of time. So we've got this one peak of time called present moment. It's the height of time. The one pointed, one peak in time. The one peak in silence. Because silence is the peak of thought. Where all thought finishes and ends in silence. It's the height, the summit of thinking, where thinking ends. And then we, instead of just having a body, we're just one peak in the body, our breath. Height of our body, the essence. And then just one peak of the breath, and it's a beautiful breath. You find, I'm going to mention this later on, you go, instead of like going high, 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 I like the idea of going in. It's in the middle of time, is now. In the middle of now, N-O-W, is O. Silence, zero, nothing. In the middle of O is the breath. In the middle of the breath is the beautiful breath. In the middle of the beautiful breath is the nibbata. It's right in the center. In the middle of the nibbata is the jhana. The second jhana is in the middle, right in the center of the first jhana. And the third jhana is in the middle of the second jhana. You go in, all the way. It's a complete emptiness where everything stops. That's what we mean by going to a one peakiness. Into the very center, the capital, the heart, the agra, the view. That's how you do it. You don't focus so much as you let go. As you let go, focusing happens naturally. When there's no wind, the leaf is still. It's in one point and it doesn't move. You don't have to hold it. You see, Simi, I've also been saying for a long time, I've been trying for 30 years to hold this cup absolutely still. And still I cannot manage to keep this absolutely still. You can look at it now, it's wobbling, it's vibrating. Doesn't matter how much I focus, how much I try, how much determination and effort to hold a cup still, I just cannot do it this way. And after 30 years, 40 years, lifetimes of trying to hold a cup still, I suddenly hear someone say, the way to hold a cup absolutely still is not this way, by trying to use force and control. The way to hold this absolutely still is, let it go. Put it down, and you see, it's absolutely still. It's not moving at all. And it's effortless. It's the easiest thing to do to keep that cup still. Keep it still for hours. And I don't get tired. I don't have to work hard. In fact, when I let it go, it's naturally still. It only moves when I hold it. You get the point? This is your mind. This is you. You try to hold your mind. Come on. Doing it for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. And you still can't keep it still. Thought here and thought there, because that's the nature of when you hold things, it always moves. So you want to get your mind still, put it down, leave it alone, and it's still all by itself. Let go. It's easy, isn't it, to meditate? Just get your mind.